ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, a major funding boost for schools in the Northern Territory, but will it make a difference in the classroom? Also, still no sign of seven people missing as vast areas of the West Australian outback are cut off by flooding. And if you want farmers to be paid properly for the fruit and veggies they produce, they're urging you to shop around.
If they still have independent fruit and vegetable stores, you will get fresher produce there. And whatever price you pay, you can be assured that a greater percentage of that will go back to the person who grew it.
First tonight, fears are growing for the safety of a family missing in severe floods in outback Western Australia. Bad weather is holding up aerial search efforts with conditions too dangerous for pilots. The widespread floods have also marooned people in remote communities and cattle stations and damaged the state's critical supply lines from the east. John Daly reports.
What a little road.
Australia's biggest sheep station now looks more like an inland sea. Almost everyone's been evacuated from Rawlinna Station, but a handful have bunkered down at the homestead. Ross Wood is among them. He's lived on WA's Nullarbor for three decades and says this is a once-in-a-lifetime flood.
Obviously, it's a massive flood event, unprecedented. Most of the homestead complex is now, flooded and remains flooded. Will be for quite a long time. We're just camped up in one building that is barely above water.
WA authorities hold grave concerns for a family of seven missing somewhere in the vast flooded expanse of the state's outback. Four children aged between 7 and 17 and three elderly people from the remote Aboriginal community of Junjunjara haven't been heard from since they tried to make the 600-kilometre drive home from Kalgoorlie on Sunday. Police say the group was carrying minimal water and food. The search via road is all but impossible right now, and an aerial search was called off yesterday because of the bad weather and dangerous flying conditions over the region. WA Police Inspector Mick Kelly.
Once we have the mobility with the air asset, we'll deploy, we'll be looking to locate the vehicle and then make communication with the occupants, and then we'll be able to get relevant resources, food, water, mobile phones, we'll be able to drop them out, and we'll be able to then work out how far from community that they may be, and then how we're going to bring those people back safely.
Police had hoped to resume the search this morning, but planes are still grounded. Inspector Mick Kelly hopes the family has stayed with their vehicles.
With the amount of water that has fallen from the skies over the last 24 hours, you would probably think that they're going to be out walking, if they would be walking, in muddy, slushy, wet conditions. So I'm praying that they've stayed with the car, and once we have the availability to locate them via air, that's what we'll be doing.
Floodwaters have also cut the state's main road and rail freight links to the east, causing some problems for supply chains and other logistics. The only sealed road linking the south of WA to the rest of the country, the Air Highway, was closed yesterday, but has reopened today with drivers warned to use extreme caution. And the only rail line across the Nullarbor remains closed. Australian Rail Track Corporation General Manager of Corporate Affairs, Anthony Meir, told ABC Perth Morning's program the line will remain shut until at least Sunday.
We're very confident our crews will be able to repair the locations quickly and get obviously trains back up and operational. But certainly until the water does subside, Nadia, it's really difficult to give an accurate perception as to what damage has been done and how long it's actually going to take us to repair those tracks.
At Rawlinna Station, Ross Wood says the unprecedented flooding has broken a five-year drought on the station, though he's unsure at what cost.
This is a drought breaker. This is a turnaround that has been required, and we all know that things turn around. You always have to take a long-term view of these things. And whilst this is a setback as far as infrastructure at the head station, then, the rest of the country will be in better position for production.
Bureau of Meteorology forecaster Jessica Lingard says this flooding is highly unusual for these semi-arid parts of WA's outback.
Well, to put it into perspective for the air station, their previous annual daily rainfall figure was just over 80 millimetres in a single day, and that was set back in 2011, also in March. But we have seen falls exceeding that figure twice, so 129 millimetres to 9 a.m. on Tuesday, 141 millimetres to 9 a.m. on Sunday. And the fact that we have received more than their annual amount of rainfall in just less than a week just proves just how unusual this weather phenomenon is at the moment.
Jessica Lingard says the weather system dropping all of this rain is expected to move east later today. It's hoped that that will soon provide authorities the clear conditions they need to search for the missing family.
John Daly. Educators in the Northern Territory are celebrating a deal that'll see an extra $1 billion in funding for schools. The most disadvantaged public schools will be given priority for the money, which will come from the federal and territory governments. It's the second deal of its kind to be struck by the Commonwealth. But will it make a difference in the classroom? Isabel Massali takes a look.
For most people, working in education is a rewarding job. But for Principal Robin Thorpe, being in the Northern Territory makes it particularly special.
We know that we do make a difference. We have some very high quality teachers and leaders in the Northern Territory, and they do make a significant difference to the lives and the outcomes of our many students, more than what you actually see on NAPLAN data.
She's also the president of the NT Principals Association, and she adds teaching kids in the NT is no easy task.
The Northern Territory does have some of the most socially disadvantaged children in the whole of the country. We have 43% of our kids who are Aboriginal. We have 40% who identify as students with additional needs, 47% of kids who have English as a second language. And 70% of our schools are actually in remote and very remote areas. So that means that we've got, you know, probably the most geographically dispersed education system in the whole of the country.
So when Robin Thorpe woke up this morning, she says she was over the moon to hear news of a significant funding boost. A deal struck between the Territory Government and the Commonwealth will see just over $1 billion in extra funding for schools in the 4 years from 2025. Robin Thorpe says while it's good news, it also raises questions.
So how would the money be spent? How would we use that funding? And we know that funding isn't the answer for absolutely everything, but it certainly does help. You know, it could be used, as I said before, to help with providing literacy and numeracy interventions for kids who need to have that gap closed. It might be providing flexible education programs for those kids who find it challenging to be engaged in a classroom of 27 other kids. It could be used for the increasing issues of well-being and mental health.
Under the agreement, the federal government will contribute just over $700 million, while the NT government will spend $350 million. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says the NT will receive the highest level of school funding per student of any state or territory, and students at the most disadvantaged schools will be prioritised. Trevor Cobbold is an economist and national convener of Save Our Schools, an education advocacy group.
It really is a landmark agreement for the Northern Territory public schools, because Northern Territory public schools are the worst funded public schools in the country. And at present, they're only funded at about 76% of their schooling resource standard, which is way below every other jurisdiction.
The schooling resource standard is a key term here, because under this agreement, the NT's public schools will reach 100%, and it's been talked about for more than a decade.
It was recommended by the original Gonski report. So it's a needs-based funding system that should provide the resources needed for all students to succeed at school.
And while Trevor Cobbold and the Education Union welcome this funding and believe it'll make a significant difference, they don't believe all the money will go to schools because some will be spent on other needs. It's an issue that'll impact other states too when it comes to striking their own deals.
The various agreements allow state governments to claim expenditures that are specifically excluded from how the schooling resource standard is measured as part of their share. And the two of the major concessions that they can claim are depreciation and school transport. But these expenditures are not included in how the schooling resource standard is measured. And therefore, by allowing the states to claim these expenditures against their share of funding the schooling resource standard, it's swindling public schools of necessary funding.
Federal Education Minister Jason Clare says changing that will require input from other states.
Well, that's not part of this agreement. What I've said is that we'll look at that with all the states and territories as part of negotiating the next national school reform agreement, as part of making sure that we build a better and a fairer education system.
This federal agreement follows a similar one struck in Western Australia earlier this year. Negotiations continue with other states.
Isabel Massali reporting. The Senate inquiry into Australian supermarket prices has heard today that close to 40% of vegetable growers are considering leaving the industry. The probe is investigating the price-setting practices and market power of the major supermarkets and has been told nearly 80% of our fresh veggies are sold through Coles, Woolworths and Aldi. The inquiry's also heard evidence from fruit growers that the practices of the major supermarkets are making their businesses unviable, and there's a risk Australia will soon have to rely more on imported fruit and veggies. Jolyon Burnett is the chair of the National Farmers Federation's Horticulture Council. He told me consumers concerned about how the major supermarkets are treating growers should consider buying elsewhere.
The evidence clearly suggests that the major supermarket chains are not treating their suppliers fairly. They are driving the price as low as possible using their significant market power. They ring around, they make sure they have the lowest possible price that is being offered anywhere, and then they insist on that price from growers. Once they've driven that price down as low as they possibly can, they then charge growers rebates for things like being paid properly, for things like refurbishment of their stores or for promotional specials that they run in their stores. It's important that listeners understand it's actually the growers that fund those specials, not the supermarkets. They never take a cut to their profit to drive a special. It's the supplier who funds that special.
So is it better for consumers to be buying fruit and veggies from their local greengrocers if they're concerned about the practices of the big supermarkets?
Absolutely. While it is true that the supermarkets have increased the quality of their fresh produce over recent years, that has come at the expense of the price they pay to their suppliers. So if shoppers are able to shop around, if they still have independent fruit and vegetable stores, you will get fresher produce there. And whatever price you pay, you can be assured that a greater percentage of that will go back to the person who grew it.
What is the pricing arrangement for those local greengrocers?
So most independent stores will go to the wholesale markets in the capital cities, and there they will buy from a wholesaler who purchases from a range of growers. That arrangement between the wholesaler and the growers is covered by a mandatory horticulture code of conduct, which specifies things like there must be a formal agreement between the wholesaler and the grower, it must specify a price, it must specify a volume, and these things are mandatory now, so all wholesalers need to sign up to that. And the power imbalance is far less between these wholesalers who may be dealing with perhaps 20 growers on a reasonably local scale compared to the power imbalance between a supermarket with billions of dollars of turnover who are dealing nationally and often internationally.
For people living in regional Australia and remote Australia, Is there much choice when it comes to buying fresh fruit and veggies, or are they usually having to rely on the two big supermarkets?
Look, there is more choice, but even in the regions, the supermarkets dominate and they are continuing to move into the regions more deeply up where I live in the Northern Rivers of New South Wales. So one of them recently opened a shop in Mullumbimby, and already we've seen a number of small independent retailers, grocery retailers, close up shop. So while there is choice, the pressure, the lack of competition is still the same. But in the regions, you can shop at farmers' markets. There are any number of these where you can buy direct from the grower. You can know exactly how that produce is grown and know that 100% of the price you're paying is going back into their pockets.
I think during the pandemic, during lockdowns in particular, a lot of people started having their groceries delivered from the two big supermarkets. And perhaps we're getting their fruit and veggies from them as well, whereas perhaps they didn't before. Is that a trend that the Farmers Federation has noticed, and is that a concern to the horticulture sector?
Look, it is a trend, but as yet it doesn't appear to be, you know, a significant trend in terms of the size of the market. Whether it will continue to grow or not, I suppose time will tell. But an alternative version of that is joining a local co-op where someone goes to the growers' markets or the wholesale markets, purchases a range of fresh fruit and vegetables, and then distributes them among the members of the co-op. And some recent research that was done shows that can lead to as much as a 30% saving on fresh produce.
Julian Burnett is the chair of the National Farmers Federation's Horticulture Council. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, promising signs China may soon lift its tariffs on Australian wine. Well, when was the last time you paid for something using cold hard cash? Most of us are hardly using it these days, and that means transporting cash from point A to B is becoming more expensive. As a result, the company that transports the most money in Australia, Armaguard, is facing insolvency. But faced with a potential cash crisis, the big four banks are now preparing to prop up the company. Melissa Clark is the ABC's National Affairs Editor. Mel, first of all, how worried are the banks about this issue?
They're really concerned. Armaguard controls about 90% of the business of moving cash, whether that's getting banknotes from the mint to the major banks or to smaller banks and from there to everywhere else, be it ATMs or small or large businesses. So if Armaguard falls over, the prospect of cash just not being distributed is a very real one, and that would be quite a crisis to not have cash getting around the country. So much so that late last year, the Australian Banking Association, which represents not just the big four banks but all the major banks in Australia, asked the ACCC for permission to hold emergency talks to devise a potential rescue plan. And this has involved the Reserve Bank of Australia, the Federal Treasury Department, and of course Armaguard itself, and a lot of the major retailers who deal with a lot of cash, like Australia Post and the big supermarkets.
So what then are the banks considering doing to make sure cash is still available around the country?
Well, the most likely outcome is that the big four will financially prop up Armaguard. That would really just buy them a bit more time to figure out what to do. Now, that's not locked in. This is part of the confidential discussions that are going on at the moment and will hopefully come to some kind of resolution by the end of the month. If they don't step in the short term, Armaguard could go into insolvency and that would lead to a cash distribution crisis. If they do to agree to this short-term plan, they would need to get that approved by the ACCC, and then that would buy them a bit more time to come up with a longer-term plan that would really need to find a new system for supporting the distribution of cash. And with the banks increasingly withdrawing from regional communities, that's a role that at the moment is falling more and more to Australia Post, which isn't really funded or set up to be a cash distributor. So there's possibly a role for Australia Post and the major retailers, but at the moment, the main issue is the short-term one of making sure Armaguard doesn't become insolvent and leave everyone high and dry.
And how did Armaguard gain such a monopoly over the distribution of cash in Australia?
Well, originally there was a duopoly. The Linfox-owned Armaguard and another Spanish-owned company, Prosegur, were the ones that controlled most of the cash distribution market. And they were both struggling last year because of the declining use of cash. So they got permission from the ACCC to merge on the basis of a couple of conditions. So that became the merged entity of Armaguard. But it was only a couple of months after that, again, towards the end of last year, that Armaguard went back to say, look, even though we've merged, we're still in a lot of financial trouble and we're not sure that our business is sustainable anymore. But the situation's a little more complicated than that, because part of the reason there was so much concentration in the first place, even going back to before the monopoly when it was a duopoly, that's partly because there are really tight regulations and limitations on the companies that can distribute cash from the Reserve Bank of Australia, where money is printed, to the big four banks. That's the only way that money initially comes out before it can then be distributed to everyone else that handles cash. So there's also questions about whether that system is really the best one too.
So the declining use of cash is the key issue here, and I imagine quite a few statistics are being thrown around in this discussion. Just how fast are people switching from cash to card or digital payments?
Look, it's a trend that's been underway for many years now, but it was massively accelerated during COVID, and it's continued at that same accelerated pace since COVID. So to give you an example, in 2010, around 62% of payments were made by cash. So more than half of all payments made by cash. A little over a decade later, in 2022, which is the most recent figures we have, it's now only 13%. So that's a really precipitous drop off. People are now using either plastic debit and credit cards, or they're using the debit and credit facilities through a mobile wallet. But here's the conundrum. Although fewer people are using cash, we still all need access to it sometimes. And that's what's making this crisis come about, is that it's just unprofitable to get a little bit of cash everywhere across the country.
Melissa Clark is the ABC's National Affairs Editor. Winemakers are cautiously optimistic that China may soon scrap its tariffs on the Australian product. The tariffs were brought in with little warning in 2020, wiping $1 billion a year from industry earnings and causing a wine glut that's seen grape prices plummet. Growers here say other countries have muscled their way into the Chinese market in Australia's absence, and it'll be some time before the industry recovers. Angus Randall has more.
$1 billion worth of exports per year, wiped out overnight. Chester Osborne is the chief winemaker at Darenberg Wine in South Australia's McLaren Vale. He was preparing for a major expansion into China when the tariffs came in.
We had about 25 importers in China. We were anticipating having maybe 100 by 1 year later, as that's how fast we were growing. So it was a very good time. We were selling about 11% of our volume, 20% of our dollar turnover, and 30% of our profit.
After 4 years of tariffs on Australian wine that reached up to 220%, there are now signs China could offer relief by the end of the month. An interim decision by Chinese authorities says the duties were no longer necessary. Australian grape and wine head Lee McLean says Chinese demand for Australian wine may never fully recover.
The China market itself has changed considerably over the last couple of years. People are also drinking a little bit less by volume in China too. So the likelihood of us going back to that $1.2 billion figure is very slim, but it will still be an important market to us if that final determination goes our way.
The tariffs were brought in during a diplomatic spat with the Australian government over issues including then Prime Minister Scott Morrison's call for an inquiry into the origin of COVID-19, as well as the Australian government accusing China of cyber attacks and the introduction of foreign interference laws. Winemaker Chester Osborne says it's not been as simple as sending the wine elsewhere.
If we could sell more wine back, you know, in 2019 to another country, I would have done it, because I might as well make more money again that way if I can. So, no, there's no way that you could increase your markets. Most of the markets in the world are going back the other way slowly, so it isn't easy.
China was Australia's largest wine export market before the tariffs. Mitchell Taylor is the managing director of Taylor's Wines in South Australia's Clare Valley. He's just returned from Hong Kong to prepare for the expected end to the tariffs.
It's been a great opportunity for the French and the Chilean winemakers to take our market share that we had 3 years ago and to develop their brands and also their relationships in the market. So it will take time to re-establish ourselves.
The interim decision marks a diplomatic victory for the federal government. In 2021, the Morrison government took China to the World Trade Organization, saying its tariffs and bans on a range of Australian products broke trade rules. Last year, the Albanese government agreed to suspend the dispute as part of negotiations to end the tariffs. Melissa Conley-Tyler is the Executive Director of the Asia-Pacific Development, Diplomacy and Defence Dialogue think tank.
We went through that process long enough to make it pretty clear that Australia was going to win the legal argument. And at that point, we offered to pause the case so to give time for China to make its own investigation. Essentially, that's saying you can save face instead of having a negative finding against you with the World Trade Organization. You can have your own investigation, say that you don't think these tariffs are needed anymore and remove them of your own free will rather than having that negative judgment against you.
So what have we learned from all of this?
I've learned that Chinese economic coercion doesn't work. And one of the things I hope China learns from this is that economic coercion doesn't work. And I think it shows that that sort of resilience that we have is really important, and we shouldn't feel that we don't have tools to try to fight back.
Tariffs on Australian barley were lifted last year, but rock lobster and some red meat is still banned. China will announce its final decision on wine by the end of the month.
Angus Randall. To the conflict in the Middle East now, and more is being done to bring food and other essentials into Gaza by sea, with a vessel now on its way from Cyprus. But UN officials say what's really needed is clear access across the territory's land borders. Rima Chia reports.
Hundreds of tents are scattered along the coast near the southern Gazan city of Rafah. For the people sheltering in these makeshift camps, food is in desperately short supply. A ship has left Cyprus and is heading for Gaza with around 200 tons of flour, rice and protein on board. But Hanan Halak, who has been displaced from the city of Khan Yunis, is sceptical.
This coming ship is part of a big conspiracy aimed at displacing the Palestinians, meaning this is an easy way to displace people. This corridor is not for food. Many trucks are at the crossings and the Israelis do not agree to bring them in. Suddenly they agree to open a port to bring in aid.
The ship has been provided by a Spanish charity, Open Arms, while the food has been supplied by a US charity. This shipment comes as the United States builds a temporary port in Gaza with the goal of bringing in aid. But the United Nations says these measures won't get aid in fast enough. Here's UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric.
For aid delivery at scale, there is no meaningful substitute to the many land routes and entry points from Israel into Gaza. The land routes from Egypt and Rafah in particular and Jordan also remain essential to the overall humanitarian effort.
Israel is under increasing pressure from the international community following UN reports of over 500,000 Palestinians at risk of famine and starvation. Joseph Borrell is the European Union's head of foreign affairs and security, and speaking at the UN Security Council, he didn't mince his words.
This is a humanitarian crisis which is not a natural disaster. It's a man-made. And when we look for alternative ways of providing support by sea or by air, we have to do it because the natural way of providing support through roads is being closed, and starvation is being used as a war arm.
Meanwhile, Qatar says it remains hopeful of reaching a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas within the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. They, along with the US and Egypt, aimed to broker the deal that would include the release of Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners, along with the entry of a large amount of humanitarian aid. Qatar's foreign ministry spokesperson Majid Al-Ansari says progress is slow.
We are not near a deal, meaning that we are not seeing both sides converging on a language that can resolve the current disagreements over the implementation of the deal. And all of us were pushing towards that happening before the beginning of Ramadan. However, that did not deter us from continuing the work and the negotiations.
If Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's words are anything to go by, a ceasefire is a long way off.
We will destroy Hamas, free our hostages, and ensure that Gaza doesn't ever pose a threat to Israel again. We will finish the job in Rafah while enabling the civilian population to get out of harm's way.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Rima Cheer with that report. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You'll find all our interviews and reports on the PM webpage. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Decades ago, when other countries were embracing nuclear power, Australia put a ban on it. Now the federal opposition wants to lift that ban and build nuclear power plants on the sites of ageing coal-fired power stations. Today, we look into the feasibility of that idea. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.